Osiris.
We're live. What's up, everybody?
We're here.
Hey, Brian.
RJ, how are you?
I'm good. Am I live?
You're live.
I'm live. I'm extremely live. So we're back. We're going to talk about some more Bruce. Spoiler alert, Brian. It might be just that I really like Bruce Springsteen, but I really enjoyed the show a lot. And I'm looking forward to talking about it.
This was, I'm going to admit something live on air, and I usually don't admit things live on air, but I'm just going to do it. You know, we got a big crowd here today. We're hanging out. We're going to be real with you. This is the first time I've listened to a 2008 Bruce Springsteen show, and I want to be real. I'm going to go back and listen to some more 2008 Bruce Springsteen shows. We're going to talk about this as we get into the show here, but there's a lot to explore and there's a lot to enjoy.
Yeah, I agree. And we're going to get into it. I guess before we do that, we want to tell you about a couple things. Brian and I have been hard at work planning some of these live shows that we've been talking about. We have two live shows this weekend in AC. We have on Saturday, we're going to do an HF Pod recap at the Anchor Rock Club, 2 to 4 p.m. The HF Pod recap is going to be pretty short. Megan and I are going to do it. And then our friend John Barber from the Disco Biscuits is going to sit down with us for an interview, and he is going to play an acoustic set of music. It's going to be really fun. Sunday, same time, same place, 2 to 4 at Anchor Rock Club. We're going to be recapping HF Pod Live as we typically do. And at the same time, we're going to be auctioning off a bunch of stuff benefiting Waterwheel. There's a test pressing of a Live One vinyl, which I'm going to bid on if nobody else does, but I think people will. There's signed posters, there's memorabilia from different shows, there's some other signed vinyl. So it's going to be really fun. You see the link on the screen if you're watching. If you're listening, you can go to osirispod.com/ARC to RSVP for those shows if you're going to be there live. If you're going to watch HF Pod live on the recap, we're going to do it through this auction platform called Whatnot, which is one of our sponsors, because they're going to be live in the room with us in AC. So you can stream Saturday's recap by going to osirispod.com/AC1, and you can watch Sunday's recap and participate in the auction by going to osirispod.com/AC2. Brian,
RJ,
in the next Thursday, you and I will both be in the Midwest together for, I think, the first time. We're both from the Midwest, but we'll be in the Midwest together for the first time. Is that true?
Man, I didn't even put that together. I think that's true. I think we've only ever hung out on the East Coast, in the Rocky Mountain West, and on the West Coast. This will be our first time in our homeland together, although not our state. Wisconsin shares a lot of similarities with Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, that whole region that we live in. Michigan, I know you're very opposed to Michigan for a variety of reasons, even though you root for a baseball team from there. Wisconsin.
Not anymore, dude. Breaking news. I'm a Phillies fan now.
So you went from one sense of frustration to another. That is going to be, we'll tackle that in the Osiris Pod baseball podcast that is coming to you live at 3 p.m. Eastern today. Keep an eye out for a link for that. But we do need to tell you that we will be in Milwaukee next Thursday, August 11th. I can't believe it's coming up so soon. We are hosting an event at the Cooperage with Riley Walker, one of our favorite singer-songwriters, a dude who just perfectly balances the kind of music I love. He can write really, really like straightforward and beautiful songs, but then also these songs that lyrically completely warp your brain and change the way that you look at the world. He can also play really abstract and really unique jams. I'm really excited to talk with him, dive into his songwriting process, where he's at from a musical standpoint at this point in time. He put out one of my favorite records of the last probably 5 years. My favorite record last year, Course and Fable. So I'm really excited to talk a bit about the process of making that record. We will be doing that. And then he'll be playing a set of music for us. So you can get your tickets for that. OsirisPod.com/Milwaukee. Tickets are $15 in advance, $20 day of the show. So really excited to see you all there. The Cooperage is also kind of your home base. If you're going to be in Milwaukee for the Alpine shows, they do shuttles from the bar to Alpine. So a great way to get to know the area that they're in, hang out, rent a kayak, grab a couple local beers, watch some music, and chill with us before the fish shows.
It's going to be really fun. And in fortuitous news, the 2022 Big Ten volleyball preseason poll just came out about 5 minutes ago, and Wisconsin is ranked number one preseason. And I just think that bodes well for next weekend in Milwaukee for all of us.
It's a really good sign.
So those of you who have been listening and tuning in and commenting and sending us emails and following along, we are going to be wrapping up our first 10 Bruce recaps. So we're going to just a programming note, if anyone, you know, is interested, we're going to skip tomorrow because tomorrow is that we're just skipping tomorrow. And next week we have AC recaps. Brian and I are going to Milwaukee. So after today, we're going to pick this up on Tuesday, August 16th, and the 16th, 17th, and 18th will be our last three Bruce Springsteen recaps. We said we're going to do two of each artist, So that week will be our last three Bruce shows. And we want to know from you who are listening and watching, if you were to choose another artist for us to cover, who would you choose? Who would you suggest we cover for 10 live releases? Because we have ideas, of course. We have a lot of ideas. We have too many ideas, and that's part of the problem. So I would like to hear, we would both like to hear from you. What do you think we should do next? What artist should we dive into? It could be an artist that we don't know at all. It could be an artist that we know better than any other artist. It could be something in between. All right, Brian? Could be anything.
Yeah, I think the joy of this is like we went into Bruce and Dave Matthews with a decent amount of familiarity, but I think you'd agree with this. We both have learned a lot about each band in this process. I think approaching live shows the way that we've approached this show could be applicable for some of our favorite bands where we could see them all in a new light and put their live releases into a different perspective, but it could also be an artist that we know nothing about. And so we are open-minded for this going forward. Whatever you, we'll take your suggestions and we'll kind of decide what to go with, right?
Yep, exactly. So that's what we're doing. So after today, we'll see you back here on August 16th, which is a Tuesday. That's during a break in the fish tour for those of you who celebrate fish tour. And, you know, we're going to get back into some Bruce. Those last three, I think our team, Brian and Matt particularly, but me by osmosis, are really excited to dive into those shows. So there's going to be a lot there. So Brian, you mentioned earlier this show that we're talking about, 32008 from the Conseco Fieldhouse in Indianapolis. This is, it's interesting. We talked yesterday a lot about the kind of old mixing in new songs with old songs, and Bruce is sort of seems to be a master at that. This show has a lot of that as well. Maybe most bands do that, but I mean, some bands just go out and play all their new songs, and everyone's like, "Give us the old songs," and they play old songs in the encore or something. Bruce really integrates it in a way similar to like the way Fish does it and the way other bands do it. But this, I really enjoyed this show. What do we need to know about this venue or about this tour before we jump into the show in detail?
Well, I want to ask you really quick before jumping into this venue. March 2008, where were you at this point in time? This is the day after my birthday, 3 days before your birthday. I've got to imagine you have like an understanding of where you were at in March 2008.
Yeah, we were just finishing our 3-year stint in the Bay Area. And I think I can't remember if it was June, must have been June 08 that we moved to Boston. So I think we were enjoying the last, you know, few months of our San Francisco stay. And I don't know what else we were doing in March of 2008. Probably like hanging out and going into the city and then like going to a dog park and then like sitting outside in our backyard with our friends in the afternoon and drinking beers and listening to music. That's kind of like, that's kind of what we did.
It's a good life.
That'd be my prediction. Yeah.
I was wrapping up my last semester of college. I'd just gotten back from spending the previous fall overseas. I was a week away from my then girlfriend, now wife, driving across the country and moving into my tiny apartment in Missoula, Montana. And she was bringing our 3-month-old dog that would become our dog that we would have until last summer and like grew up with us, was there with us for our kids, all that sort of stuff. So this was like a big period of transition for me. And it also, I think on like a larger scale, as you know, I was listening to this record and I was thinking about our conversation from yesterday. We're like on the hinge of a really monumental shift in American society, American culture. The financial crisis is 6 months away. Obama's election is 10 months away. There's a lot that's happening at this point in time that like informs both the songwriting of this record, as well as informs kind of like where I think both of our lives would go. By the end of the year, I was back home in Chicago, plotting out my next move to move overseas for a bit of time, but also helping work as a volunteer on the Obama campaign and, you know, relishing in what that all meant by year's end. So really, really wild. 2008 was a crazy year for me. I lived in Alaska for a little bit of time. I graduated college. I was like all over the place. So I was thinking a lot about that when listening to this, this show.
Well, we both did a bunch of cross country drives in 2008, I think.
We did.
You know, I had a crazy 2008. And we moved, we got married in 2007 in Maine while we were in Boston for the summer. And then we drove back to California. And then Rachel finished her last year of law school. And then that spring, I think it must have been May or June, we drove back to Boston for good with our cat and our dog. And we moved into a new place and I started a new job. And then 6 months later, I got a different job, which was the last job I had before this, the job that I had for, you know, for 10 years before I came over to Osiris full time. But I feel like we've gotten slightly off track.
We have. We should bring this back in. And so we should bring it back in by way of this venue, which is the Conseco Fieldhouse, which opened just a month after the Staples Center, which we talked about yesterday, the 10/23/99 show. Not to get us too far off track, but this does host the annual Big Ten tournament, which I think means a lot to you. It doesn't mean as much to me, even though I grew up in Big Ten territory. I was always told I should be a Fighting Illini fan. And I was just like, why they're 2.5 hours south of me? I don't understand. I'm a Chicago Bulls fan. But like, have you ever been to the Big Ten tournament?
I have not. I have not. And I have never been to the field house here. But I do think that Indianapolis or Indiana in general is seen as like one of the birthplaces of basketball, you know, rightly or wrongly. With the Larry Hoosiers Bird connection and
Larry Bird. Hoosier.
There's a lot, you know.
There's a lot there. It's truly Middle America. We're Jack and Diane territory, if you will. Jumping into this show and where this show finds the band. So this is in the middle of leg three of the U.S. Magic Tour. So they toured behind the album's release, which came out in September 2007. I remember I was in Amsterdam and I got an email from my mom saying, you have to listen to the new Bruce record. Everything. I spent much of the 2000s trying to convince my mom to come on to the side of voting with me, and she refused to. And then she listened to Bruce Springsteen's Magic. And I think it changed everything for her. She said, it's everything you've been telling me over the last couple of years. I said, wow, Bruce Springsteen, like tapping into young millennial frustrations. I got to hear this. But this was leg three. It started on February 28th in Hartford, Connecticut, and it ended on May 2nd in Sunrise, Florida. Shows from April 18th to April 21st were rescheduled. Basically, the entire Florida leg were pushed back 2 weeks because as we're going to get into, one of the founding members of the E Street Band, Danny Federici, played the Glockenspiel, played the organ, played the accordion, was a huge, huge part of the sound of the E Street Band. Sadly passed away at the age of 58 in mid-April 2008. So they pushed those shows back 2 weeks. Bruce and the entire band attended Danny's funeral. Bruce played at his funeral, read a eulogy there, and then they jumped back on the road to complete the tour before finishing out the Florida shows. This tour, I was looking through the Bruce Wiki, which is just like, it's basically the equivalent of Bruce's fish.net. It's got everything, all the information, all the insights. It's got pictures from each show, who all played within the E Street Band at the time. It's got breakdowns of Bruce's lengthy monologues from a song by song standpoint, history, stats, everything that you could ever want. This tour features a ton of random openers, a ton of setlist hijinks, partially from what the archivists seem to tell. It's due to the vibe of the tour. They knew that Danny's time was limited. When they played on following his passing, they started to really open the songbook and really allow new rare songs to open things up. And then just to like kind of backpedal really quickly, you know, this tour, it's the third leg. Fall 2007 marks this 32-year period for the band as the E Street Band. And something I want to get into as we move into this show. Obviously, the E Street Band didn't play together for 11 years, but there's 32 years since the founding of the band. And this kind of feels like the beginning of the end of what the E Street Band is. They've been back together for almost a decade at this point in time. Federici took a leave of absence in the winter of 2007 and then couldn't rejoin the band for the start of the 2008 tour as he was battling melanoma. Was able to kind of revive himself, get to this show, play a few songs with the band, and then was sadly unable to play any more songs with the band and passed away less than a month later. RJ, jumping into the show, I guess the best way to start this is, what is your relationship with the record Magic, if you have any, and like, what is your perception of this album at this point in time?
Nothing until now. And I'm going to go back to it and try to, you know, understand it. I mean, I've listened to it for sure. I've listened to every album of his, like, even, you know, I've listened to everything, but, you know, I don't know that much about it. And I found myself enjoying the songs from Magic that I knew about. And so, you know, I was going to ask you and just, so I don't know the songs that well. I know the songs from the show that are on the album.
Yeah.
But we talked yesterday about 2003, and you and Matt both were like, you know, Bruce was kind of trying to claw his way back, as I think what Matt said, into relevance in mainstream rock music. And I didn't remember this yesterday, but this morning when I was listening to the show, this show again, I was like, well, The Rising came out like after September 11th, right? Early like 2002.
Yeah.
But so 2003 was after. I kind of like associate The Rising with like his rising again. But is that not true, or did that start it and then it continued with, you know, Magic and some of these other kind of mid 2000s albums, or when did he make it back? Because now he's like, I would argue in some ways he's bigger than ever. And I like, what does that revival look like? And also like the Seeger Sessions in 2006, 2007, that was a huge moment, even though it was so different. So what's like, when did he make it back?
I think the argument could be made that, you know, the 99 comeback was seen as a comeback but it was seen as a like a moment in time. I don't think anybody expected when they came back that there were going to be new songs. I don't think anybody expected when they came back that there was going to be like a true future for the E Street Band. I think that the expectation at the time was, we get to see Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band again. And kind of what we talked about yesterday, it was at a point when rock comebacks were starting to become kind of the norm. But a lot of them didn't lead anywhere beyond the initial comeback. You'd go and you'd see a band get back together. It was this thrilling experience, but it felt in a lot of cases like a like you're taking 1982 and placing it in 1999, but with graying hair. And the graying hair kind of turns a lot of the fan base away. But the shows were so good and the tour was so good. Even if aspects of it don't totally hold up 23 years later, it was so good in the moment that there was a ton of energy, I think, within the E Street Band, as well as in the larger Bruce community, to basically say, let's keep doing this. Let's keep this going. So that tour wraps up in summer 2000. 9/11 happens about a year later. Following 9/11, Bruce just starts writing songs. And it's just like an outpouring of songwriting. And I think building off of the momentum of the 99-2000 tour, these new songs that he's overall written, he puts out The Rising, and that kind of takes the success of the comeback tour and cements it as there's another chapter that we did not know. And this is, again,
which did go to number one on the charts in 2002.
Goes to number one, his first album since Tunnel of Love to go to number one. It was beaten, though. This is a very 2002 moment by Norah Jones's Come Away With Me for the album of the year. But, you know, The Rising is a huge record. It's got a ton of bangers on it. And he goes on tour again through late 2002, early 2003. I saw him on The Rising tour in summer 2003. And the cool thing about that tour was that it gave you this perspective of what the 99 tour did, but with new songs now. And so you're mixing in this new sense of Bruce with the old. To kind of fast forward, you know, Devils and Dust comes out in 2005. That's a solo record that is kind of an update on Nebraska, Ghost of Tom Joad. It addresses a ton of themes around the war in Iraq. He does the Seeger sessions.
Also goes to number one, Devils and Dust.
Also goes to number one. He's on a streak. I think where Magic comes along is almost like, and this is what, so for me, Magic is the best post comeback Bruce record. It's the one that sounds the most like a record from the 70s. It's the one that has the songs I identify with the most. Mm-hmm. To me, it's the record where after he made The Rising, he almost had nothing left to prove. He'd made the comeback. It was incredibly successful. He'd made a new record with the E Street Band. Incredibly successful. He'd figured out this pathway where he could be creative as Bruce Springsteen, which is what he tried to do in the early 1990s and commercially was successful, but was not as critically successful, while still having this relationship with the E Street Band. And that back and forth was something I think he had been searching for the previous 15 years and finally found. In a lot of cases, he never needed to write another E Street Band album. He just needed to tour with the E Street Band while doing all this stuff creatively on his own. But Magic proves that there's another pathway for the E Street Band. And if you take Magic, if you take Wrecking Ball, if you take High Hopes, and if you take Picture of You, which came out in 2020, you get this like this these chapters that nobody thought ever would have been written in their career that add to these shows over the previous 15 years, intermixed with the River Tour, intermixed with moments where he's playing Born to Run in full, where he's playing, you know, these records from the past. It allows him this freedom, just to put a bow on this, to tap into the best parts of his past while also looking ahead at where his inspiration is guiding him.
Thank you for that. I will say, well, I'm gonna get Magic on vinyl. That's gonna be my next Bruce record. The last one that I have chronologically at this point, this might shock you. What would you guess is the last chronological Bruce LP that I own?
I'm gonna go with Tunnel of Love.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And I'm gonna get Magic. And also, that was the last one to go platinum. And that has more to do with kind of the way the music industry changed probably than the quality of the record, but that's where we are. We're post Magic, and I guess because this is called like, because it's the Magic tour, there's like this circus intro in the beginning, and it's so cheesy. And I think even in 2008 it would have been cheesy, but Bruce starts yelling and he's going nuts and it's high energy, and they go into Night, which I think is just awesome. And then you, so you get like this, you know, you get a 1-2 from the start. You get a Born to Run song followed by Radio Nowhere, which is a magic song. And it just kind of like, it continues to kind of go back and forth. You get like Lonesome Day, which is from The Rising. And then you go back, you know, again, and you get Prove It All Night. And then you get Gypsy Biker and Magic. It just keeps going back and forth, which I think is pretty cool. One of the things that stood out to me, and we can talk about the Danny stuff, obviously, but Steve Van Zandt's singing to me is like kind of vocal harmonies in this show is much, seemed, it was just more prominent to me than in previous shows that I've listened to. And I wonder if that's like, because Patty wasn't on this tour, right? She was
right.
She was at home with the kids, and he's like, "Someone's got to watch those bastards," and which seems like it that doesn't age that well. But he's stepping up in this show, and I really liked his vocal harmonies with Bruce on Radio Nowhere and Prove It All Night and Gypsy Biker, Long Walk Home. There's a lot of moments in the show where Steve's vocals like really come through. I don't know if you noticed that or if that's like a thing that people have talked about, but it's sort of surprising to me a little bit.
I totally noticed it. I was listening to it this morning when I was driving to take the dogs out to, like, we have this big open space park I take them to, and I was just, it's 5:30 in the morning, driving down back roads, blasting Radio Nowhere, and like Steven is yelling at you. I have a theory about this. So little Steven in the 70s and 80s is Bruce's wingman. And he's kind of the guy that like, he both gives Bruce some credit because like some street cred, because he looks like a really tough guy. He's the guy that like the Glory Days video, he's right there as you're like, you need someone in the bar, be it to like, you know, back you up if you're getting into a rough and tumble with some guys, or if like you're trying to approach a girl, like you've got Steven there to like back you up in every single situation. But then he goes off and forms his own solo career and it does not work out. He comes back for some moments on the Born in the USA tour. 90s, he's kind of, you know, just drifting in a lot of cases. And then his whole life changes. He gets hired to be on The Sopranos, takes this chance from an acting standpoint, and it completely clicks. Like there's nobody who could be Silvio the way that little Steven is. And that role kind of works perfectly because the role of Silvio is to be Tony's right-hand man and to be, you know, his, they're in the back room of the Bada Bing trying to figure out like, do we have enough money to survive? Who do we need to whack? What do we need to do? Who's getting promoted? He's always there with him. And you kind of see that relationship work in the same way that Bruce and Stevens does, where there's clearly moments where Tony's like, what the hell are you telling me what to do? You're my right-hand guy. But from a personal standpoint, little Steven's career takes off in a totally different way. And he's recognized in a way that's outside of Bruce's shadow for the first time ever. Along with this, he's running little Steven's underground garage radio station. And he is really showcasing to people that this is a guy who's not just the biggest rhythm guitarist in the biggest band in America, but he has a deep, deep knowledge and understanding of American garage rock and underground radio. And all of this kind of leads to Magic being a kind of vocal point and like a focus on little Steven. And it almost sounds to me on this show that Bruce consciously knew Steven's got to be more front and center. And you hear it, like him belting out the Radio Nowhere chorus, it wouldn't sound the same without his vocal tone and without his guitar on that part.
Man, so he's basically been a sidekick his whole career. And maybe just like at some point I was like, all right, well, that's just how it is.
I think he tried to go off on his own with Lilyhammer. Did you ever watch that show?
Yeah.
Like it was like moderately successful, but
yeah. Not No Sopranos. I just also like Gypsy Biker. I really like that song. I really like the songs that I'm not super familiar with from this era. I just think are really great. So, you know, I'm pretty happy with all these all these songs, and I had a good time listening to them. There's no real like Bruce revival moment. It's sort of like, it's sort of just a run through of songs, which is cool. The Long Walk Home, I guess that's where things start to get like kind of more emotional. That song in particular, that was like one of my favorite moments there. But I guess before we get into the sit-in with Danny that you went through, what else were you noticing about the show as you went through it?
The show feels a lot different than the shows that we had listened to in the first six or seven volumes of this collection. One of the things I've noticed about Bruce shows to this point is he tries to, and I mean this in a positive way, he tries to overstuff these shows with songs and with segments. And as a result, when you're listening to these, like as a listener, it can be a really exhausting experience in a way that I think it's like designed to be that way. and I think it's like a cool feature of Bruce is that like you go and see one Bruce show, you walk away feeling like you just saw three or four. Like it works in the same manner of like a playoff game versus a regular season game, where you just like you come out feeling exhausted physically, but also like fulfilled in a really, really impressive way. This show feels much tighter, which I think, you know, is kind of a theme of his arena shows versus his stadium shows. It also does a really good job of like, you know, you talked about it, the intro to this, the first six songs kind of throw you back and forth between here's older Bruce that you all know that you're all celebrating and newer Bruce in terms of Magic songs, in terms of the Rising songs. As you get into the latter part of the show, it's wild to me how he instinctively seems to know the bangers that are going to close this out are the songs that are 20 and 30 years old. And it's almost like he's resigned himself to the knowledge that, you know, you think about 70s Bruce, where he's ending with the current songs from that moment because he doesn't have any other songs. In the 80s, he kind of starts to figure this out, that the way to end these shows is with Detroit Medley, is with Twist and Shout, is with these bar band throwbacks.
Yeah, sure.
He knows here that like, if you don't end with Badlands, Backstreets, Kitty's Back, Born to Run, Dance in the Dark, and then American Land closing things out, like people are probably going to go away a little bit disappointed, right or wrong. And so he overstuffs the end with like, this is classic Bruce. Thanks for being with me throughout this journey tonight. But for me, when I was listening to this, like I loved the entire journey because I really like Magic. And I think that him still figuring out ways for these new songs to fit in a set list is really impressive.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. And I think the whole thing, like I'm not familiar really with like Devil's Arcade, and Last to Die. And I mean, like some of these songs that it fits really well. And I don't know if it was like by design. Long Walk Home, as I mentioned, I thought was really good. So I don't know if it was by design or if it was just like choosing songs. I know that the Bruce Bass Wiki says that Prove It All Night, Rendezvous, and Dancing in the Dark are played by request. But who knows, they might have played those anyway. But the Danny Federici thing, as you mentioned, he was sick and he came in on Promised Land, Spirit in the Night, 4th of July, and Asbury Park. That's like a pretty awesome segment, although he doesn't talk a lot. He doesn't like talk about the situation. I mean, it's just sort of like, we're going to bring our friend out who was a member of the band for, but at this point, 30 years. It's pretty, but it's good. It's like, it doesn't feel like mournful or anything. It feels like pretty like high energy, and it seems pretty cool.
As I understand it, the perception at the time was that people were really shocked when Federici wasn't able to join the 08 tour. The way that it was messaged in 07 was he'd been diagnosed with melanoma. He was going to get treatment for it, and he would join the band back out on the road. They brought in the organist from the Seeger Sessions, who fit in really well. you know, at this point in time, the E Street Band is a tight machine. They've just recorded a record together. They kind of recorded the record in like a scattered standpoint because Steven had commitments with his shows. Max had commitments with Conan O'Brien. Bruce basically like made the record with Clarence, and then everyone came in when they could and added their parts to it. It's still very much an E Street record, but it's not like they're playing live together in the studio. So at this point in time, swapping members in and out isn't necessarily unthought of. You know, there will be a point in a couple of years where Steven has to bow out for a couple of reasons because of his show schedule, and Tom Morello will join on rhythm guitar, which is really wild. But when the 2000,
we had a Tom Morello sit in with Dave Matthews, right?
We did. Yeah. He's kind of like, it's, we were talking about it yesterday, like Rage Against the Machine kind of gives Bruce Springsteen street cred. I don't know if Dave Matthews has benefited from the street cred that Tom Morello gave Bruce Springsteen. It'd be interesting if like that was a feature of them. But yeah, he's played with both of them, which is kind of wild.
Maybe that should be our next artist. Maybe should be someone who Tom Morello sat in with. Maybe that's where we have to go next.
That is the through line. The Morello show.
That's the through line. So how did you feel about this? How do you feel about this segment though of the just the Danny sit in?
It's really emotional. You know, I think you're right. Bruce doesn't spend a ton of time talking about it because I think the perception was that at some point Danny would be back. But I think that there's also by this point a knowledge that the disease is taking him more quickly than people would want. When he wasn't able to play the 08 tour, they kind of, you know, I think it gave them a sense of like, holy shit, like something really serious is happening here. And the fact that he was able to play that night, I think Bruce is really kind in the fact that he's not saying anything about it. He's just celebrating that Danny's back and that we can't let him get away tonight without playing one more song. So he stays on, he stays on in the middle part of the show and then he comes back for the full encore. I think Bruce treats it the way that every one of us would want it to be treated while giving his fans a gift of like, you know, ultimately we have it preserved on tape, one final performance with one of the original members of the band. What were your thoughts on it?
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. It just seemed a lot more upbeat than I was expecting, knowing all the context and if you haven't read Bruce's autobiography, I mean, he talks a lot about Danny. He lived with Danny in his apartment with Danny and his wife during like some of those years where he wasn't able to afford his own place. I mean, he was one of the first people I think that Bruce like really got to know in Asbury Park. And, you know, they were friends, very good friends for a long time. He does talk about like Danny's hard living a lot in the autobiography, whereas Bruce, like, at least according to the autobiography, I think he never had a drink until the day after the release of Born to Run. And then he went out and like discovered tequila or something like that. It was crazy. Anyway, it's a great book. That section on the Born to Run writing and release and how his life changes is really fascinating. But anyway, I really liked that segment. But I felt like the Devil's Arcade, Rising, Last to Die, Long Walk Home was more emotional than like the part with Danny, partially just because those songs have a little more emotion kind of like built in. But I thought this show was really great. It really actually made me want to go and listen to these records that I don't have a lot of familiarity with. And then he in Backstreets, which is toward the end of the show and Kitty's back, they dedicate that to Danny, which is a little bit more of an emotional moment, I think, than even the sit-in was.
Yeah, I kind of think that segment that you referred to, the Devil's Arcade through Long Walk Home, you've got to imagine, you know, seeing him on stage for the first time. Who knows how many times they'd seen him since he had gone in for treatment, kind of hit everyone in a really hard way of like how much strength he had to resolve to come up on stage for Promised Land Spirit, Asbury Park, that those songs then kind of take on a deeper meaning. And it sounded that way to me when I was listening to it. The encore, then it feels like an elevated Springsteen moment, where there's already so much emotion, so much thrown into this, but now you're taken into the fact that it's pretty clear you're probably not going to play with this friend, with this musician that you've been recording with ever again, unless something, you know, truly incredible happens. You know, to me, it makes me think about like conversations we were having yesterday about the 99 tour, that Bruce throughout that show seemed almost apologetic to his bandmates of like, I'm really sorry we let this, you know, linger for so long and left you guys kind of out in the dark. We're back now, and I needed you just as much as you needed me. You get a sense now, 9 years later, of the challenge of breaking something up like this, because who knows when someone's life is going to end and all of this change. And it really feels like this is like the end of the E Street Band, as like a, you know, they've continued on for the last 15 years, but as a proper connected group of guys. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, then, you know, Clarence died 3 years after this, right?
Right.
And it does seem like there's a lot that changes. And the Kitty's back, and the Born to Run, and all the American Land. I mean, Dance in the Dark. That was all. It felt like a real celebration of the band, you know, which is pretty cool. So I like this a lot. I thought it was great, and I don't know. It's just it's wild. It's wild that this was like towards the end, you know.
It's also around the time that
into the show.
Yeah. It's also right around the time that we're transitioning to something Matt talked about last week when we talked about this show from Helsinki in 2012, this idea of the E Street Band Orchestra. We're going to lose Danny. We're going to lose Clarence in 3 years. We're at a point where Bruce has to kind of decide, am I going to keep this band together in the way that we are? I can't just replace these guys. I have to replace them with something more, which ultimately means more people on stage. With Clarence, he's replaced with an entire horn section, because how do you replace the big
right.
man?
Right.
And as a result of that, like the band's sound is going to grow in a way that I don't know if it would have had these guys lived on with them.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. I mean, there's, I guess just like the construction of the set gives me more, it just makes me feel like they had a lot more thought went into it, you know. Like we talked about how the new and the old and the mix and all that, but like it does feel like there was a lot of thought given to the mix of all this. And I will also say, just for people who want to check this out, there's some videos from the show on YouTube as well. So there's some there's Backstreets, Promised Land, Born to Run, and some others. So if you want to check those out. Brian, what's the most boss moment for you here?
So this gets into something we were talking about yesterday. I'm really curious your thoughts on this. For me, it's the speech at the start of Living in the Future, which is one of my favorite songs, one of my favorite late era Bruce songs. It's a third track on Magic. And as Bruce talks about, this is a song that addresses the last 8 years of American politics and American history, where rights have been taken away. There's wiretapping. This might be affecting you more because of the color of your skin. This goes a lot in line with so much that we've heard throughout the entire series here. Number one, there's always charity that Bruce shouts out within his shows, which is right there, which is a really cool thing. It's right there at each concert. It's a local charity. There's the Chimes of Freedom and Amnesty International moment in the Tunnel of Love show that we talked about. There was the speech against corporations taking over public spaces in the 99 show that we talked about. But we've also had this underlying thread of, you know, the ticketing issue that's been going on right now. And I'm curious from your standpoint, like Bruce, this is right around the time where I remember hearing criticism about Bruce from the right that, well, he's never actually worked in a factory. Like all he's doing is writing about working in a factory, but he's never actually done it. To me, that aspect never mattered, because he captured the essence of what working class America seemed to be going through the last 2-3 decades of the 20th century better than anyone else. But he walks this very strange line that I think we, you and I, have to accept in a lot of cases, which is, you know, he just did this podcast with Obama. He's incredibly wealthy. He lives in a totally different life than the vast majority of people that he's singing to and singing about. But yet at the same time, he's still focused on civil liberties. He's still focused on liberal causes. To me, and I want to get your opinion, I kind of just shrug as this is the way it goes. He becomes really successful because his ideas, his words have a ton of impact on people. But he is not really walking the walk that he is talking about. Do you have an issue with that? Or do you see that as kind of just like, that's the way it goes when you become successful?
Yeah, sort of the latter. Although when I was listening to that speech about the Constitution and civil liberties, it reminded me of how now saying that, like basically that entire speech is what like conservatives would say today.
True.
You know, like, right. Right. It's like they're trying to like take our constitutional rights away from us, which isn't real. But I think that's interesting that like that speech could be like now about like anything that conservatives are trying to push. But yeah, you know, like these guys, I mean, I think it's interesting and sort of quaint that like he is in all these shows, he's talking about specific local organizations, food banks, you know, I mean, I think that's like, I think it's pretty cool. I mean, he doesn't have to do that. We know so many other artists who don't say anything about any causes ever, you know? So I think the fact that he does it at all is fine. And we shouldn't begrudge him for being successful and wealthy, but it seems like he does a pretty good job of trying to talk about, I don't know what he does with his money or if like philanthropic things, but you know, I think he's okay in my book.
It's great in my book. It's kind of wild to me, like how much this wraps up so many of the conversations we have on like a larger level about like, should you be, if you're going to be professing these values, should you be looking at least a little bit more like you live those values and you truly understand people who are living those values? I don't know. I don't really see it that way. The quaintness also, just to kind of wrap this up, I found it in everything he's talking about was so true and so relevant in 2008 and has only gotten worse.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was just like, it's going to blow me away what he talks about when he reemerges here for the 2022 and 2023 tours. What was the most boss moment for you?
I think it was the encore Backstreets dedicated to Danny, Kitty's Back. Like that just, I thought it was handled well. And it seems like the audience was into it. The band was into it. And then, you know, playing Dancing in the Dark by request after Kitty's Back, Born to Run. Is great. I love that segment. I really like this whole show. And like I said a few times, I'm ready to go back and listen to some of these albums. I'm gonna buy a couple of these records and just keep it going, keep the learning going. Well, we're gonna let you guys get back to your lives. Before we go, we should say again, if you guys are interested in checking out our live events, I'll be with Megan from HF Pod in AC this weekend. Brian and I will be in Milwaukee with Riley Walker next week. Everything's at osirispod.com/osirislive if you want to read about these different events we're having, and we'd love to see you out there. It's a lot of fun, and thank you for tuning into this. And I guess the other thing, as we said at the beginning, if you have thoughts on the next artist you think we should cover, send us an email or an Instagram or Facebook or Twitter message or, you know, any of those ways, you know how to get a hold of us. And I think with that, we'll see you guys back here on Tuesday, August 16th, and we'll pick up the Bruce conversation. Anything else, Brian?
I would just say we are covering a huge show in Bruce's history. We're covering 12/31/1980 when we come back on August 16th. It is a massive show. There are five or six moments where Bruce is like, how much time do we have till midnight? This is coming off of the River Tour. This is the year that my parents met and fell in love over this album. So I'm really excited to dive into it. I've listened a little bit to the show in recent weeks. It's one of my favorite shows. And then we'll have two more Bruce shows to close out this season on Bruce Springsteen, one of which... we're diving into a controversial era that I can't wait for. But we will be back in 10 days, 10, 13, yeah. 2 weeks basically to cover this.
Yeah, and we're going to wrap up at the last three of the 10 Live Bruce releases, and then who knows where it's going to go from there. But we'd love your input, and thank you all for tuning in. We're going to see you guys very soon. Thank you for listening and watching.
See y'all soon. Osiris.